Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, April 15th. Hopefully, everybody's done their taxes. So the time is 9:10. Sir, so you haven't done your taxes, Senator Kelly? Okay, Senator Kelly is here, for sure, and Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop.
Morning.
Morning. And Vice Chair Fairclough. So we do have the full committee. I see some folks here representing the education community, and you're always welcome to our committee meetings, but we will not be taking up education this morning. We're going to be doing a whole bunch of House bills, House Bill 210, House Bill 32, House Bill 199, House Bill 239, House Bill 240, House Bill 241, House Bill 242, House Bill 75, House Bill 378, House Bill 293. A lot of these we've heard, and we'll just take up for additional discussion and then see where the committee wants to go. So is there anything to come before the committee before we get started? Okay, then let's start with House Bill 210, which was schools, restraint, seclusion, and crisis training. So the committee heard this bill yesterday. We took the public testimony. There was questions from the committee. We reviewed the fiscal note on it. Let's see, is Representative Millett here or Igie? Igie, come on up, sir. If you could put your name on the record for us, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ike Yalopsos, staff to Representative Millett.
Okay. Did you have any additional comments you want to make pertaining to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, no, but the sponsor wishes to extend her sincerest thanks to the Finance Committee for hearing the bill at this time of the year. She appreciates how busy every member is.
Okay. All right. Would you like us to move it on?
Mr. Chairman, I would believe that's a fair assessment.
All right. Is there a motion from Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman.
210.
Well, I'll just move it. It's not on either of the motion sheets, but that's all right.
House Bill 210.
It's okay. I can do it anyway.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move from committee House Bill 210, CS for House Bill number 210, Finance, amended, version B.A. Is that correct, Christine? From committee with individual recommendations. And attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Any objections? I'm moving committee substitute House Bill 210, Finance, amended, version BA, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Seeing here none, bill moves out of committee. Thank you, Igie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we're back. Next bill before us is House Bill 32, Lines of Business on Business License. Let's see, this bill was heard Sunday, April 13th. The sponsor is here, Representative Castillo's staff, Charles, is here. Charles, go ahead and join us, if you don't mind. Appreciate you joining us again today, and welcome to Senate Finance. Was there any additional questions that committee members had on this bill? Anything? Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chairman, my only question is that we heard an issue related to multiple professional licensing and only having two lines available under the current IT system. And so I know that we are trying to move things with very low fiscal notes to make sure that we can be as effective as possible inside of the current financial constraints that we have. I'm just wondering how the department is going to be able to manage the new request based on the issues that were raised by at least for 85 businesses that have more than two lines of business.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charles Ginchard, staff to Representative Costello. Senator Faircloth, through the chair, to address that concern, I'll first pose it from the sponsor's perspective, and then, of course, I would welcome the department to offer clarity that I'm not capable of. Senator Faircloth, through the chair, the sponsor, in looking at this bill, sees that there are approximately 53,000 active business licenses in this state. This bill could affect up to a little over 750 of those licenses. For those 750, it is up to that business owner whether or not they consolidate under one business license. The gap in the data that you were referring to then, of course, affects only those who have three or more, which is down to 85. So that it's the sponsor's belief that given that this loophole applies to 85 out of the 53,000 active business licenses, that's something that we can figure out a way to address that other than a significant, a very expensive update to a database.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Senator Faircloth. Sponsor, do you have any other comments on the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman, other than Representative Costello sends her regards as she's attending to her obligations down the hall at the moment.
Okay, that's understandable. Would she like the bill to move from committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 32, version 28-LS0192/R from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing here none, bill moves from committee. Take a brief at ease. All right, Senate Finance is back. The next bill before us is House Bill 199. And let's see, this bill was heard on March 27th. This is the BPSO firearm bill for those who don't follow the numbers. Let's see, do we have the sponsor here? Oh, yes. Why don't you come on up? We were just commenting that this bill's gone a long ways without being amended, so you must have done a good job. Why don't you put your name on the record for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman, who sends his apologies. He's down the hall in your counterpart committee in the House.
Okay. Is there any questions committee members may have? It's been a while since we heard this, but yeah, it seemed like a pretty good bill, pretty clean. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Clark, I guess I was just wondering, during the last period of time since we heard the bill, has there been any more input from either people for or against it?
None to my knowledge. I know that many of the issues that did bring forth comments were addressed during a very thorough committee process, both in the House and in the Senate, with your companion bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Senator Olson. Any other questions? Seeing none, any additional comments?
Only that I'm fairly certain Representative Edgman would appreciate it if the bill were moved.
All right, very good. Okay, then we'll take your suggestion. Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 199, version 28-LS0739-U from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there any objections for House Bill 199 moving from committee? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves out of committee. Let's take a brief at ease. All right, Senate Finance is back. The next bill before us is House Bill 239. I think I saw the sponsor. Yeah, Representative Ryan Bolt's here. If she would, yeah, you might as well just stay there. Representative Ryan Bolt, welcome.
Good morning.
To Senate Finance, you have a series of bills here, 239, 240, 241, 242. I wish we could do one motion for all four, but we can't, so we're going to take them individually. So we'll start with the extension of the board examiners in optometry. I believe we heard this actually yesterday. Was there any additional questions, comments committee members had? Any questions? Well, I guess you wouldn't have any questions, Representative Reinbold, but any comments, Representative Reinbold?
Mr. Chairman, as you and the Senate Finance members saw yesterday, the Board of Optometry Examiners is doing a good job, and we hope to keep them in business. So we're hoping to get this bill from committee.
Okay. Very good. Senator Kelly, are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I would move from committee HB 239. With attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. The title is the Board of Examiners in Optometry.
Okay. Is there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves out of committee. So we'll take a brief at ease.
Okay, we're back. The next bill is House Bill 240, extending the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Oh. We also discussed this one yesterday. It does have a fiscal note as well. Is there additional questions, comments? Sponsor have any comments?
We just appreciate the bill moving on.
Okay, excellent. Then Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 240 from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. The title is Extend the Board of Chiropractic Examiners.
Okay, any objections? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves from committee. Ready for these? Okay, we're back. Set of finance. We're now taking up House Bill 241, extending the termination date of Board of Marital and Family Therapy. Again, this bill was heard yesterday. Small fiscal note. Additional comments, questions? Seeing none, sponsor, comments?
Just a quick one. This is a piece of legislation I married, so I hope this moves on, and this will help keep our marriages and families strong in Alaska. So hope this moves on out of committee.
So you have a conflict of interest? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe it's a complementary interest.
There you go. Okay, excellent. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 241 from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. The title is Extend the Board of Marital and Family Therapy.
Okay. Any objections to House Bill 241 moving from committee? Seeing here none, bill moves out of committee. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back. The next bill is House Bill 242, extending physical therapy and occupational therapy board. Again, we heard this yesterday, had discussion, heard from the sponsor. Is there additional questions, comments? Seeing here none, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I would move HB 242 from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. The title of the bill is to extend physical therapy and occupational therapy board.
Okay. Seeing and hearing no objections, bill moves out of committee. Thank you very much, Representative Reinbold, for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good luck everybody this week.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we passed, four of your bills out this morning, so that's a record. Thank you very much. Okay, we're at ease.
Okay, we're back, and then we have before us Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 75, Finance. This bill was brought up yesterday. This has to do with the PFD audits and the university. Actually, I think I was gone when this bill came up. So why don't we have Representative Seaton join us? Representative Seaton, I apologize. I wasn't here to hear your bill, but the committee tells me it's a good bill. Do you have any additional comments to make pertaining to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Seaton, Homer and Lower Kenai Peninsula. I know the committee received a full presentation yesterday, but what this does is it allows greater participation by small nonprofits. The current audit requirement is more onerous than that required by the federal government. It requires a CPA audit, which is $9,000 to $12,000, which those smaller nonprofits don't receive. We've heard from senior citizen centers and arts communities that we're above that $250,000 total budget, and therefore they couldn't participate in this because they wouldn't receive as much money as the audit costs. So the new 990, which is 12 pages long, which requires that financial disclosure that's available to the public, takes a place of that CPA audit for these small associations. If they're required to do the federal audit, they must submit that audit. That's $500,000 or more of a federal grant. And so I think that we've reached that. The other portion of this bill provides for sustainability. The Rasmussen Foundation was going to take this on and do the outreach for 3 years. They've been doing it for 6 years, and to have it sustainable and not have any requirement from the state budget, there's a proposed 7% coordination fee. I think you have version Y before you, which makes three technical corrections in drafting errors that just make sure that the bill can be implemented. And I'd just like to put on the record that the university currently has all 12 of its campuses listed. Some of them don't make enough to justify the $250 fee, and the website is being corrected, and we'll push to have that as a single university and then a subset, so that when people want to go to the university, they can, it won't be confused, and I think it will get even shorter because some of the rural campuses will be removed. And so, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them. And I would just like to note that I guess the teleconference wasn't working yesterday, and Jordan Marshall from the Rasmussen Foundation is here in person if you wish to ask Rasmussen anything.
Okay. Well, very good. I believe we do need to adopt the CS, so I don't think we have actually got the CS before us. So I got it, yeah. Senator Kelly?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt Senate Finance CS for HB 275 version Y as our working document.
Okay, great. Thank you. My apologies. I should have asked for that up front. And so what were the changes, Senator Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's three basically technical changes. When they were drafting the bill, they had some problems. So subsection amends a notice provision on the PFD so that it will say that the 7% coordination fee will be deducted. Subsection E removes the restriction that the money contributed through PIC give cannot be used for implementing the section.
Yep. Just Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I can't follow where the changes are being made at. Is there a page number or a section that we can drop into?
Is A, page 1, section 1?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I might bring my...
That's your enforcement. Up. Okay, that's fine.
For the record, my name is Heather Begg, staff to Representative Seaton. The changes come in subsection A, and that is on page 2 of version Y, line 12. where no money has been changed to 7% of the money. The second change is in subsection E, which is on page 4, lines 5 through 8, deleting that section that would restrict the department from implementing the new change of section N, which is the regular bill.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that explanation. Is there questions for the sponsor and or his staff? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Representative Seaton. Now, I understand we do have a representative here from the Rathmussen Foundation, Jordan. And I think again, I wasn't here yesterday, but I'm told that we had some technical difficulty and you didn't have an opportunity to testify. So if you would, please go ahead, Jordan. The public testimony is closed, but we can still do invited testimony. So if you would put your name on the record for us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jordan Marshall. I'm staff at Rasmussen Foundation in Anchorage. Okay. Thank you for your interest in making the Permanent Fund Dividend Charitable Contributions Program, also known as Pick, Click, Give, a stronger and more sustainable program. I am prepared to provide testimony or stand by for questions.
If you want to say a few words, and then we'll
thank
if there's
you.
Any questions. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman. The Alaska Legislature has been an excellent partner in providing Alaskans with a safe, secure, and simple way to make optional gifts from to Alaska nonprofits when they file online for their permanent fund dividends each year. Picklick Give is now in its sixth year and has seen over $10 million in designations made by Alaskans like you and me. This year alone, $2.77 million were raised. Today, you have an opportunity to strengthen the program with several enhancements to statute that will help ensure Pick, Click, Give stands on its own two feet. The CS before you would make three main enhancements that have been discussed already. I would, if I could, point out that the sustainability filing fee portion was come to and brought forward to you for consideration after having reached out to participating nonprofits. After 5 years of steady growth, Pick, Click, Give polled its participating nonprofits on a number of issues, the most important of which was rating various scenarios for creating an ongoing sustainable revenue stream to support statewide coordination, education, and marketing of the campaign. Thus far, those costs have been borne solely by Pick, Click, Give funding partners. What was learned in the polling of participating organizations is that nonprofits overwhelmingly said that statewide campaign was an essential component of Pick, Click, Give. In fact, 85.6% said so. Those same organizations endorsed adjusting the annual participation fee to cover the cost of a statewide coordinator and annual outreach campaign. The poll presented several sustainability scenarios for consideration and feedback, and the primary sentiment was that collecting a percentage of donations was the fair and equitable way. Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the Pick, Click, Give partners, funders, and participating nonprofits, I respectfully request your favorable consideration of HB 75. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jordan. Questions? Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome. Can you tell me, have you done an analysis of the nonprofits that are shown in the advertisement, whether they see a higher rate of giving than those that are not?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, the individual organizations that might be highlighted in a statewide campaign, there have been concerted efforts to highlight certain types of service offerings. For example, aid and comfort to people who are homeless, and in those cases, in the year when we focused on those in a statewide marketing campaign, we did see a small uptick in support for those types of organizations. But Senator Fairclough, through the chair, in the last several years of marketing of the Pick, Click, Give campaign, no specific organization has ever been highlighted as part of the full statewide outreach.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, so what I'm wondering is as the state, if the state is taking over the paying for or producing the statewide message, I just want to make certain that we have on the record that it needs to be issues-driven, and I'm not sure how they'll select those issues, but it does make a difference to the nonprofit. So if you, as an example, are a group and there's a domestic violence message out there, then those groups might see more donations flowing to their organizations. Or if you were highlighting food, you might just see more donations to food. And so I'm just wondering how we'll go about shaping those priorities, because it will affect those participating. And I should say that, you know, I have a bias as a former executive director of a nonprofit, and I'm working in the field, that if I see something that's outside of the area that I'm working in highlighted, I know it's harder for me to get my donors per se to the Pick, Click, and Give site to donate for me, because the messages are very powerful. They're wonderful messages to motivate people to give, and I'm 200% behind that. I just want to make sure that that we raise different issues. So one year it might be arts mixed with social services, and another it might be something different that is represented in the programs.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, I appreciate those observations and agree that certainly should a particular organization or service type be highlighted, that it may well, in fact, draw additional donations to that type of organization. Two thoughts, if I might. First, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division contracts with an outside organization, in this case, the current contractor for the 7% fee for the statewide coordinator would be likely to be the Alaska Community Foundation Pick, Click, Give program there. And the state has thus far had no interest or desire or any influence over which items are highlighted. And given the fact that I believe you're absolutely right, I would be happy to put on the record, we would be correct to rotate through the focus areas as each year goes forward.
Anything else, Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. I'm just looking for making sure that all nonprofits that are qualifying for the $250, that there's some kind of a rotation. Mm-hmm. Though I know that the Community Foundation is partnering with United Way to implement a 2020 plan, and so we've been focusing on, at least the first time it rolled out, on reading readiness, on children being fed appropriately. But you know, there are tribal issues, there are educational issues, there are arts issues, and you guys have done a phenomenal job, as long as we're looking at that so that we know there are particular beneficiaries that are benefiting at a greater level than those that are sitting on the sidelines that might not be highlighted in that advertisement. I'm fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Fairclough. Thank you. Jordan, anything else?
Thank you, Senator Fairclough, through the chair. I might add that the PickClickGive.org website allows for, and we've enhanced the offsite statewide coordination and outreach mechanism so that participating organizations can, in fact, upload the most current information about their organizations. They can upload videos, stories, photographs, and etc. So every participating organization has the prerogative to highlight their works in ways that could certainly make them much more accessible to the public. And those organizations that have taken advantage of that opportunity are featured on the front page of that website.
Okay, excellent. All right, seeing no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm gonna, at this point in time, just take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back. We were discussing the committee substitute for House Bill 75, Finance. And is there any more discussion from the committee members? Hearing none. There is a Senate concurrent resolution that will need to go with the bill itself. So, Senator Kelly, if you can make that motion, and there's an indeterminate, there's a couple fiscal notes, one indeterminate, one small one. So if you can include the fiscal notes as well.
Yeah.
Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 75, version Y from committee, with attached fiscal notes, individual recommendations, as well as the accompanying Senate concurrent resolution.
Great. Thank you, Senator Kelly. Any objections? Seeing here none, bill moves from committee. Thank you. Representative Seaton. Over at brief at ease. Okay, we're back. Senate Finance, we're going to, for now, skip over House Bill 378. There is a committee substitute being copied. So let's go to House Bill 293. It's the same sponsor, Representative Wilson, and her trusty staff, Becky Rooney, is here. Becky, if you would join us. This is, oh, you're not Becky. Okay. Sorry.
I hadn't been yet.
House Bill 293, bearer license plates. And this is a new bill. We haven't heard it. So if you could put your name on the record for us and tell us why this is a good bill and why we should support it. The floor is yours.
Thank you for hearing the bill. I'm Sherry Klein, staff to Representative Peggy Wilson, District 33. Representative Wilson introduced this bill originally to add an option to our primary license plate. One of her constituents talked about how many compliments he used to receive and how many questions he would get about Alaska when he was down south, when he had the bear license plate in the 70s and 80s. It was Alaska's bicentennial plate and was readily recognized down south as a symbol of Alaska. A recent poll at carinsurance.com shows that our yellow license plate is one of the least favored in the 50 states. We think that the bear is pretty symbolic of our whole state and will give residents an option as a primary plate. We talked to past commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and he mentioned that the main reason the bear was chosen back in 1976 was that it represented something that all of Alaska has in common. As all of you know, there are bears all the way from southeast up to the Arctic, in Kodiak, throughout Fairbanks, the interior, southwest, pretty much the entire state. The current version in front of you also includes changing the wording in Statute 2810-181 for specialty plates for active and former firefighters and EMTs. It will remove the words active and former from the specialty plates. The purpose for doing this is so that all firefighters and EMTs, whether they are active as volunteers or paid employees, former or retired, will have the opportunity to be recognized for their dedication and service and will be able to purchase the specialty plate. It will lower the years of service requirement for former or retired firefighters or EMTs to 5 years from the current 10. This bill will not change the requirements for active firefighters or EMTs. And lastly, the cost for all the firefighter and EMT specialty plates will be the same, $30. We've had concurrence from the Alaska chapter of the National Volunteer Fire Council and have heard support from various fire departments and police departments around the state. That is the entirety of our bill.
Okay, great. Yeah, I would have been disappointed if we'd gone all session and not had a license plate bill, so thank you for bringing this forward. Okay, so any questions? How come our yellow plates were ranked like 48th out of 50 as far as attractiveness?
I wasn't able to get on the internet before I got here today, but it was 48 out of 50 last week still.
48 out of 50. Wow, because I kind of like that. But I like the bears too, don't get me wrong. Senator Bishop.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there any discussion, because this is the first time I've seen it, is in the other body, about the totem pole plate? Did anybody bring that up? This A67 Centennial plate. I kind of like that one. And I just wondered if anybody ever commented on that in the other body.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I don't recall anybody mentioning it in the two committees that we were in.
Thank you.
Okay. Did you want to make an amendment to include totem poles?
Well, if we're going to hold the bill, I might. I've got some people working on it. But if you want, the committee wants to move it, that's fine, too.
Oh, we got time.
Yeah, we got time. What, you don't like bears? Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chairman, I'd like to hear from the department as far as how many different types of plates we issue.
Yeah, we got to be driving them nuts. Amy, if you wouldn't mind, join us, please. Amy, put your name on the record, please, for us.
Good morning. Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Through the Chair, Senator Faircloth, I think there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 different license plate styles.
Senator Fairclough.
Do we have a standard base plate, though? And apparently that's what is competing on whatever this website is?
Oh, I see what you mean. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, that sounds right, that it's our standard plate, the gold with the blue flag, that isn't probably very desirable to consumers, but for law enforcement, we have an excellent plate. It's very visible.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
You got lights on your cars, too, but they're visible.
Okay. Senator Delaney.
Through the chair, is the mosquito template at all being pondered for license plate?
I'm unaware of it.
Yeah,
okay. Fresh. All right, if there's no other questions, was there anyone for public testimony? Okay. Anyone here? Maybe the superintendent of schools, you want to testify on the bear plate? Okay, she's good. All right. Okay, then we'll close public testimony. Senator Bishop, we could hold this bill if you want to work with the sponsor on this. Is typically what happens to a license plate. It gets.
I would. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So we close public testimony. Fiscal notes, pretty small. And so we'll hold this over for another day to give Senator Bishop an opportunity to meet with Representative Wilson. Okay, so now let's go back to House Bill 378, and everybody should have, Christine, you're going to, okay, we should have Senate CS for CS for House Bill 378. I'll need a motion to officially put that before us. Senator, version Y.
Okay.
Senate CS for CS, House Bill 378, version Y.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt Senate Finance CS for HB 378, version Y, as our working document.
Okay, great. Is there any objections? Seeing here and none, we have the committee substitute before us. Christine Marsigan, staff to myself, if you could explain the changes, please.
For the record, my name is Christine Marsigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer on the Senate Finance Committee. Before you, in version draft Y, the only change is an addition of a new section. The new section can be found on page 4 of the bill. Following section 3, the new section 4 also adds to AS 28.10.411 by allowing the waiver of a registration fee for Alaska National Guard members.
Okay, and this idea for this amendment actually came from a bill we previously heard in committee, is that correct? So it's not a new idea.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. This committee heard Senate Bill 141 a few days ago, which basically does the same thing.
Okay. Okay. I have a question. So is this at 100% or 50%, the registration fee?
This would entitle one vehicle registration fee, or one registration fee.
Okay. Let's take a brief at ease. Okay, Senate Finance is back. So, Ms. Marsigan, this will probably then attract a fiscal note, a different fiscal note, is that correct?
That is correct, sir. You should have it before you a new fiscal note from the Senate Finance Committee. That basically will show a loss of revenue of approximately $100,000 a year.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. It's here. Okay. Any other questions? Let's see. All right, let's bring the sponsor back then. It's not Becky, it's Sherry. Or no, it is Becky. Okay. You guys are confusing me. Okay. And Ms. Erickson as well. Great. Okay, so Becky, any comments, questions?
Well, for the record, Becky Rooney, staff to Representative Peggy Wilson. And she is fine with the addition. She wants to see the CDL program stay in place, and that's very important to her, so she's happy to accept the CS.
The amended
bill? The amended version.
Yeah, sure. Okay, great. Thank you for pass our thanks to Representative Wilson. Ms. Erickson, any comments?
For the record, Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I am slightly confused by the new fiscal note because the fiscal note that the division submitted to Senate Bill 141, which is what this language is, was $200,000 each year because there are 4,000 National Guardsmen that would qualify at $100 free registration each 2 years.
Yeah. That's, you're right, that's what it was. Let's take brief eddies. Senate Finance is back. Christine Marsigan, can you explain the fiscal note maybe for the committee, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christine Marsigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer in the Senate Finance Committee. In discussions about the fiscal note, as was stated by the division, there are 4,000 National Guard members, and they estimated at $100 apiece that the registration fees would be closer to $400,000 biennially, which would mean $200,000 each year. It was also then postulated that not all 4,000 members are going to run out and get a vehicle registration for one vehicle. It was further postulated that there are a number of people that car share, own motorcycles as a primary vehicle. Some people might use the one free registration for additional vehicles such as boat trailers or other such things since they probably already have their vehicles registered, sir.
Okay. All right, thank you. Christine, why don't you stay there? Ms. Erickson, can you come back, please? So this fiscal note was actually prepared by us, Christine, is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. And so does the department agree with these numbers?
Uh, Through the chair, with that explanation, I can't argue with that explanation.
Okay. It's just that you may be back next year asking for additional money if the estimates are wrong. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Erickson. All right. Thank you, Christine. Okay. Any other questions, comments on the bill, on the fiscal note? Okay, seeing and hearing none, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 378, Version Y, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And the fiscal note is the new fiscal note adopted by this committee.
Okay, is there any objections for of the bill moving from committee as? And the two fiscal notes that are attached to the committee substitute. If there's no objections, then bill will move out of committee. So we'll take a brief at ease. We are back, and so that concludes our business for today. This afternoon at 1:30, we will be hearing Senate Bill 220, which is PERS TERS. Senator Kelly, any comments on what we're going to be hearing?
PERS TERS.
Okay.
Sure. We'll have David Teal and others to testify.
Okay. Comments. All right, so stay tuned for PERS TERS this afternoon. As far as an education bill, not sure if that'll be ready for this afternoon yet or not. So that one is still, we may bring that up under bills previously heard. Otherwise, with that, we are adjourned till 1:30.
Welcome to Senate Finance. It is Tuesday, April 15th. It's about 1:40. Present at the table are Senator Myers, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Faircloth, myself, Senator Kelly. Senator Bishop is in a transportation meeting making quorum. He will probably be here in a few minutes. We've been talking a lot about PERS and TERS through the year, and we have another presentation today that I think will further narrow us on our pursuit of dealing with the unfunded liability. And we have David Teal from Ledge Finance here to present. And David, go ahead and make your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And I know you heard from the administration on the...
Excuse me, David, just a moment. Could you pull the microphone just a little closer?
Sure.
Thank you.
I know you heard from the administration. Well, I tell you what day you did, but I don't know what day it is this time of year, so I guess I won't tell you, but you know you heard from him.
Still struggling on the microphone, David, sorry.
Okay, so what I hope to do is add some context to the governor's proposal, and by that I mean putting it, showing you what happens in the fiscal outlook model, which you've seen before. So I won't take very long to explain that. It just shows revenue, the budget with zero growth. We do have education, what we've put in there is House Bill 278, and then a growth rate for Medicaid. But essentially it gives us a pretty conservative look at spending projections. Statewide is where retirement assistance is included, and right now the state assistance to retirement is the base scenario. If we keep doing what we're doing, these are our expected payments. Roughly $700 million per year now, going up towards $1 billion by 2024. And then the capital budget, unknown at this point, but we're just holding a flat $550 in there. The real issue here is that the deficit, projected deficit, is large. $2 billion falls down to under $1.5 billion, and then you're back up closer to $3 billion by the end of the forecast period. That's probably easier seen on this chart, which shows what that means to reserves. Our $15 billion in reserves at the end of this year, under the projected expenditures and revenue, will vanish by 2024. And it's this situation that drove the concern about controlling retirement costs. The governor presented a plan, and that plan is a proposal to fix the retirement systems. It includes a $3 billion cash payment, and I'm just going to switch the outlook model here to the governor's proposal. You can see that his proposal is a $300 billion cash infusion in 15, and that reduces reserves immediately by $3 billion. And then, of course, because of that infusion, you can reduce your annual payments. As the annual payments are lower, eventually these lines converge. But by the end of the payment period, you really haven't changed your reserve position at all. In fact, your reserves are lower in every year until we get out here. And if this went further, we would see that under the governor's plan, reserves are in a better position than under the base scenario. Unfortunately, they're still negative. So it doesn't make any sense to show negative reserves. We're just at zero in 2024 under the governor's plan, or if we continue what we're doing. This shouldn't be any surprise. Even the pay-as-you-go method, which was designed specifically to increase the life of our reserves, increase the flexibility of using them, made a difference of about 1 year or about $2 billion in the reserves. And that was out in 2024. So that $2 billion savings was enough of a savings that it satisfied some who were very concerned about the flexibility and the life of our reserves. Unfortunately, that $2 billion savings is probably insufficient to invest in the gas line, and that was the purpose of saving the reserves in the first place. So it didn't work as well as we'd hoped there. It did move cost to the future. It had higher long-term costs because it had moved cost to the future. And it was a non-standard actuarial approach and also non-standard from a credit rater's perspective. It did what it was designed to do, but I guess in the short way to say it is nobody liked it. So I want to very clearly describe the situation and in my opinion and my view, and that's that the methods acceptable to actuaries and credit raters cannot significantly improve our reserve health in the near term. That reserve health can be improved, but not by changes to the retirement system. And third, the governor's plan wasn't really focused on near-term solutions. It was focused on a long-term view, long-term health of the retirement system. Now, one at a time on the reserve chart, the governor gave it back to the life of reserves. The governor's plan does not significantly increase reserves, nor did pay-as-you-go. Second, if you want to improve reserve health, you're not going to do it through the retirement system. It's going to take some revenue increases or expenditure reductions. And you know, you can go through here and change growth rates, you can change education or anything else, but it's easiest to just say, we don't care where the reduction occurs, let's just reduce. And so if I put a number in here for capital, it's going to reduce spending, and you can see that reducing capital budget by, in that case, $400 million a year does have a large impact on your long-term reserve.
David, I just want to restate what you kind of brushed over the top of, and you're not proposing reducing the capital budget. You just use that line because it's a general fund line and it's reductions, whatever.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Anywhere you reduce the budget works exactly the same way, and that was just a very easy place in the model to make that happen. So I think a $150 million capital budget would probably be less than required to make our federal match. It's not something that you probably want to do. It's not something Suzanne would want to do.
That's why I brought it up. I heard a little gasp over here. Better say something.
So once you're convinced that the retirement system is going to gobble up your reserves one way or the other, perhaps you want to switch your focus from preserving reserves in the short term to more of a long-term fix. And just to, for example here, the governor's plan spends $3 billion cash infusion plus $500 million a year for 9 years. That's another $4.5 billion, and so the total expenditures on retirement under the governor's plan are $7.5 billion in this time frame, which is half of your reserves. If you continue to spend $500 million per year, in another 10 years you've spent another $5 billion of those reserves. So the retirement plan is capable of consuming the entire CBR over the next 20 years, if it if you can reduce spending in other areas, it will still leave you with zero reserves in the future. So if we can just get away from the 10-year look and go out to a very long-term look, and by long-term, this is all the way out until the retirement system is fully funded. It's not the end of the retirement system. That goes until the 2070s or perhaps later. But under any acceptable actuarial method, they want to have a funding ratio of 100%, and it's that whole, once you're at 100%, your contributions go to zero and you will coast on your earnings. That has some risks, but you know, those are something that future legislators can address in, you know, in the 2030s and beyond. There's nothing you can do about it now, because these models are projections, they're not predictions. And if there's one thing I can tell you about these models, is that they're wrong when we go out that far. I don't know how, whether it's going to be, which side it's going to err on, but they're not going to be right. So this is a different view of the world, but the same story is the same. Here you can see under the base scenario, we will pay annual payments, state assistance, and that this is cumulative cost, it's only TERS, but the picture is the same for PERS, so it doesn't really matter, it just gets complicated if you try to put too many things on a graph. So it's going to show you the cumulative cost of paying off the unfunded liability in TERS, which is under the base scenario is about $8.5 billion. The governor, because he would put a cash infusion in and then pay less, and you can see pay less because the slope is lower, so at some point you cross. No surprise there, that crossover period occurs the same place it did in the other graph, 2023 or so, when both the base scenario and the governor scenario have spent the same amount of money. Coincidentally, it happens to be the same time that we're predicting reserves to be gone, but that has nothing to do with this. Here we're simply looking at retirement costs. So as you cross over, the governor's plan becomes less expensive in the long run than doing what we're doing, and in fact, in the end, we save about $500 million. So other things equal in the fiscal outlook model, cheaper retirement costs means lower deficits in the future. So what we're looking at here is taking away our reserves, but the lower slope means lower deficits, and out here is where you're really going to see it, because the annual payments are still $500 million per year, and here the slope is greater than that, so you know you're paying more than $500. I don't know that it's critical exactly what you're paying. The graph should give you a pretty good idea of where you end up, and that's the most important thing to get out of this graph is the long-term cost. So you face some tough questions. If you're committed to paying retirement benefits and you're committed to having a healthy retirement system or systems, do you really need the flexibility in your reserves to do that? And you've already seen that holding money in reserves like the CBR doesn't really help you. That if you have a larger cash infusion, your annual payments go down, and in 2024 you've used those reserves. It doesn't matter whether you've used them for a cash infusion or you use them for annual payments. By 2024 you've used the same amount of reserves. Here you can see that you use less reserves because the line, the cumulative cost, is lower. So That statement applies to any and all plans that are actuarially acceptable. And what I did here was just add several more plans, which makes a very messy graph. But I think it's not so bad if you take it little bits at a time. This graph is the pay-as-you-go scenario. It does exactly what it was supposed to do, which was spend less in the early years through 2024. You pay for that in the long run because you just keep paying. And in the very long run, the pay-as-you-go plan switches from being the cheapest plan to the most expensive plan. Again, its purpose was to preserve reserves. It didn't really work to do that unless you consider $2 billion working. But remember that those $2 billion in reserves that you saved would have been consumed faster under that pay-as-you-go plan. So now there's something to note that every one of the other plans, the actuarially acceptable plans, have some things in common. They all cross over the baseline right in this area, 23 to 24. What that means is under any of these scenarios, your total cost, annual cost plus cash infusion, is about the same. And it all happens at about that same time. So there's this circle in here that every plan is going to rotate around. And by rotate, I mean that if it's higher over here in the early years, it's lower on this end, which simply means, to quote Buck's actuary, you always have a choice. You can pay now or you can pay more later. And paying more now can significantly reduce your total costs. Okay, this is undiscounted dollars, and you can argue that undiscounted dollars is not an accurate way to look at things, but there are some things that I think are interesting, that if you discount at 8%, which is what they claim they will earn on money, then all of those plans in the long run will cost about $4.5 billion. That shouldn't be any surprise because that's what we owe in unfunded liability. And at an 8% earnings rate, they all pay off the unfunded liability. There's no reason that you would pay any more than that, and every plan has to pay off the benefits. It's just a matter of when you choose to pay them. So there I can change that if you want to use a more reasonable discount rate, like the rate of inflation only. It doesn't look that much different than a non-discounted rate. It jams things up, so I'm going to go ahead and just go back to a zero rate because the lines are a little further separated and it's easier to tell them apart as we walk through various scenarios. All are within about $500 million in this 2023-2024 crossover point. So what you'll see here is that as you add a cash infusion, $2 billion cash infusion, you now have several ways you can go. This lower line is this $2 billion level percent of pay, which is just an actuarial method, which sort of backloads. So it's a little cheaper than other lines that have a $2 billion cash infusion in the early years. But by the time you get out to the end, the cost is pretty much identical to the governor's. If you were to go to the extreme here that we're allowed and go to a 30-year amortization, then you extend the payments quite a bit longer. Here, payments stop where the graph turned flat. So under the base scenario, that's in the early 30s, the governor is mid-30s, and this would extend payments out until beyond 2040. You can switch to level dollar. Level dollar adds a little more money in early years and reduces total costs. If you wanted to go to a $3 billion cash infusion, you have various plans. This is a fixed payment of $151 million per year. That's going to cost a little less than other $3 billion cash infusion plans, and as I said, they all rotate around this point, and in the long run, that plan will cost you less. If you want to go to level percent, that will cost you a little bit less. If you want to go to level dollar, it's going to cost you $5.5 billion now instead of $8.5 billion to pay off the unfunded liability. So back to the question about your commitment to the system and the tough questions. If you're committed to paying the benefits, why would you choose any method except the cheapest one? And I think there are several reasons you wouldn't necessarily pick the cheapest option. The first is that you don't want to pay off the entire unfunded liability. You could, for instance, here pay $4 billion, and that $4 billion would be a flat line. But it also means that if we're fortunate enough to earn more money than 8%, that we end up having more money than we need. There's no reason to immediately go to 100% healthy. We've got years and years and years to get there. So the second reason is that reserves outside the retirement system have a clear and I think definite purpose. They allow you to reduce spending gradually rather than taking drastic measures that would be forced upon you when reserves are all gone. If you put them in the retirement account, you cannot get them back out. So although the system is very healthy, you as legislators may be forced to take some actions in either the operating, the capital budget, or you know, enact taxes or get rid of the dividend or something, because you have no reserves to rely on. So there's that question about balance between the retirement system and your budget and the health of the economy. Second or third is that raters look both at unfunded liability and at your reserves situation. They're both important. I don't know which is more important. They're both, according to the raters, worth about 10% of your bond rating, credit rating. So now you have a fixed payment proposal by the governor that's a bit non-standard, not in the sense that it's actuarially unsound. It does pay the unfunded liability and is a perfectly defensible method. California uses the method. However, from a bond rater's perspective, they have their own models, and they're going to take our data and run them through their models. It doesn't mean that we can't explain that we use a non-standard method and they can't adjust. It's just there would be some explanation needed there. But the existing law doesn't really need to be changed at all. It works well right now. What you're really looking at here is various amounts of cash infusion. The more cash you put in now, the cheaper it is in the long run. But as I said, you need to balance that against your need for reserves. So you don't need to change the law, but I suggest that you do. And that's just following the advice of NCSL experts and other national experts, task forces, that have said, put your actuarial method, put your plan into statute, because in the absence of GASB funding guidance, there is no plan out there for you. There's nothing for you to follow. Putting it in statute makes the raters happier. It makes the public happier from the perspective of we can now see whether we're following the plan, whether we're paying off the unfunded liability as we expected to. So now, that's easy. We simply put the actuarial method, level dollar, level percent, and the term over which the unfunded liability is to be amortized. So your real decisions come down to fiscal notes and the method and term of amortization. How you decide your fiscal notes is, of course, up to you. But here are some things that you might want to think about. PERS is in more shape than PERS is. Its funding ratio is about 53%. And that's in the danger zone in terms of anybody looking or comparing the health of retirement systems. For each $1 million you contribute to TERS, you increase that funding ratio by about 10 points. So $1 million cash infusion brings you to 63%, $2 million brings you up to 73%. If you wanted to go with $3 billion, you're above 80%, which is considered definitely out of the danger zone, but 70% is not bad either. Now, TERS is a single payer, and therefore a better investment than TERS. Single payer, what I mean by that is that the state is going to pay for TERS, whether they pay for it to the school districts or whether they pay for it in state assistance. Nobody else makes TERS contributions except school districts in the state. PERS is currently at about a 63% funding ratio. But their bigger system, larger unfunded liability, and it now takes about $1 billion would move you up to 68%. If you want to get above 70, it's roughly a $2 billion infusion required. So there the problems are that a portion of the cash is essentially revenue sharing or municipal assistance, because you could look at this as the state is putting in cash, where's the municipal share? Where are the other employers' share? And they're not doing it, we're paying on their behalf. Nothing wrong with that, as long as you don't mind the revenue sharing, municipal assistance, whatever you want to call it, paying on behalf of the munis and the other non-state employers. Another thing to consider is that municipalities are going to have balance sheet issues because of the GASB rules. They have to now report the unfunded liability on their balance sheet, and that's going to make some municipalities look pretty horrible in terms of their financial standing. But in order to pay off enough of the PERS liability, you're going to have to kick in several $1 billion. I just got some runs this afternoon. I haven't run them. They're a little surprising because it would turn off the state assistance sooner than I thought, but it doesn't reduce the unfunded liability any sooner. It just means that the rate is now dropped to 22% because of the cash infusions, so that the state doesn't have to pay, but that unfunded liability still exists for the municipalities and for the state. It's just the cash infusions reduced it. Now, about $1.5 billion to each system would get both systems.
David, could you pause just a moment? Senator Fairclough has a question.
Sure.
Mr. Teal, can you where's the sweet spot on the contribution in the PERS and TERS that you hit the 22%? How much cash infusion?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I've got some runs here that I haven't really looked at. I can tell you that a $3 billion cash infusion cut state assistance to zero after 2018.
That's directly into PERS, Mr.
That's directly to PERS.
Thank you.
So if you were to do $2 billion, the state assistance continues through 2038, which is more what I would expect. Based on that, I would say that a $3 billion cash infusion to PERS is more than you would probably want to put in. $2 billion is fine, but you may not need to put in more than $1.5 billion, which would get you up into the mid-70s for a funding ratio.
Can we pause just for a second? So $1.5 billion in PERS gets us into the healthy zone. From an outside investor perspective. In PERS, somewhere around $1.5 billion, and in TERS, it's about $2 billion.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So a $3 billion cash infusion split, evenly split a little heavier towards TERS, works fine. Exactly how much you want to put in depends on your view of this trade-off.
Right.
Pay more now or pay more later. That you get the same trade-off on your choice of assumptions, whether it's level dollar or fixed payment or level percent of pay. It's just a trade-off that's not quite as critical, but it's that trade-off between pay it now or pay it later, because you can't wish this debt away. There's only two ways to get rid of unfunded liability. One is to pay it off, and the other is to be fortunate enough to have good investment climate and you earn your way, or partially earn your way out of the system. That's why I would recommend not going above 80% or so funding with any cash infusion, because that gives you enough assets to help earn your way out of it without any danger of going too high, without any need for a reserve account on the side.
Jim, another question? Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other thing that I agree with most of what we've heard today, but it's been stated more than once that as far as our bond raters go, that when we look at the cash infusion, the best bang that we're going to get for our buck is about 10%. Is that what I heard you say? Under the two criterias, reserves in the bank and 10% for the cash infusion?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough,
what's the ratio here you're talking about?
The ratio, it's not a ratio. It is
criteria.
The bond raters or credit raters criteria. And earlier this year, the Department of Revenue handed out something in Senate Finance that listed those. The health of your retirement systems is about 10%. And that is the only black mark, or the biggest black mark, on our credit rating. The other things, including reserves, reserves outside, in other words, the CBR, is another 10% of our rating. So, you know, we've got a huge CBR balance, and I mean, I would guess that the raters would say if we had $5 billion in reserves, that we would be in great shape if we weren't facing the large deficits we're facing. The point is that the bond raters or credit raters look at a number of things. Unfunded liability is about 10%, and your reserve position is about 10%. So I can't say whether it's better to switch reserves from the CBR to retirement system. They're weighted about the same, and we do know that there's just some rough rules of thumb here for retirement systems. If you're under 60%, you're in the danger zone. If you're over 80%, they look at it as sort of, you're not 100% funded, but you're not in any grave danger of going broke either. They'd like to see ratios of 100%, but they know that that 100% ratio depends upon economic conditions, particularly market, and there aren't many systems right now that are funded close to 100% because of the market losses that we all experienced.
Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I don't want to be contrary to that conversation, but I thought that we heard in the presentation from the administration earlier this week, page 16 of the presentation, when we talked about the unfunded liability, that I believe it was the commissioner talked about 20% of the rating agencies count as far as our debt as part of that conversation, and 30% of our financial strength for a AAA rating has to do with the rainy day fund and the no tax anticipation notes. So I was trying to sort of gin up with which is right. Is it 30%, or is what you're telling us 10 and 10, and that's 20, and so it's in the ballpark? And I just trying to understand if it's really only 10%, if it's 20% accumulative impact, or if, as I have in my notes, it's somewhere between 30% and 50% impact on the two ratios. So I don't know if we need to hear from the administration, Mr. Chairman. I just want to know the impact, right or wrong.
Can you save this question until we're done with
Sir.
David, go ahead, David.
I'm ready for questions. That's all I have.
Okay, all right. Well, why don't we have, are all three of these here or just two of them? Oh, all three. Mr. Bader, why don't you, you're probably the best on the questions that Senator Fairclough had, is it? Any of you, all of you, come on up to the table.
The bench.
Take a brief at ease as we switch out here.
Now we have Devin and the bees. Yesterday we had Angela and the bees. Senator, sorry, Mr. Mitchell, you're going to have to leave. You have the wrong last name. go ahead. Senator Fairclough, do you want to prompt them with the questions that you had?
Mr. Chairman, I just heard different percentages provided to the committee based on how our what criteria would be used to review our bond rating at a national level. And so we just heard that 10% and 10% were part of the criteria, but on slide 16 from the presentation, I think it was yesterday, but the days are running together, I thought I wrote something down in my notes that said, in evaluating a AAA rating, the bonding agency would look at the state of Alaska's financial strength, and that would represent 30% of the review criteria. And I don't know if what our financial advisors are telling us is embedded in that 30% and that it's a separate piece of the 30%, or is it 10 and 10 or is it 20 and 30? Because I had a 20% figure written down as far as what our overall debt would do. And that included pension in my notes.
Through the chairs, Devin Mitchell, debt manager for the state of Alaska. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I think that the preface that you had to that information in committee earlier this week is that there are three independent rating agencies that review the state's credit, and they have different criteria that they look to for purposes of establishing our rating. I don't know them all off of the top of my head. In an earlier presentation that I gave to the committee, I referred to, I believe it was Standard & Poor's criteria, which is 20% of their weighting goes towards debt, and that includes both pension liability as well as other obligations of the governmental unit. The criteria that Angela or Commissioner Rodell may have provided earlier this week, I believe, was for a different rating agency, potentially Moody's. And if it was financial strength that she was referring to, then as you supposed, that is a combination of a number of factors that would include unfunded liabilities and debt and fiscal practices generally.
If I might follow up, so we're taking a conservative approach in what our financial analysis is doing at the 20%, and you're saying that at 10 and 10, and you're saying that what we were provided earlier in the week is saying it's giving us a range between rating agencies, which would be 20 and 30%, not including those two numbers together to be 50%.
That's correct. They would be independent. Yeah, they would be either 20% in one scenario or the 30 in the other scenario. Yeah.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Devin. He was right on the money. That was right exactly from my notes. So good.
Through the chair.
Senator Fairclough, go ahead. Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, as we consider the unfunded liability and try to balance the reserve issue with considering a cash infusion, I wonder if both Mr. Teal and the administration could talk about the returns from the ARM board or the PERS and TERS accounts compared to the CBR. And where I'm trying to go for the committee is, if we're trying to get money to help dig us out of the liability, where does the money serve Alaskans the best at? Not overfunding. I think that we've been given some sideboards on a phased approach to get where we want to be, but where does the money benefit Alaskans the best?
David, you want to start off with that, or Mr. Bader? You seem to be grabbing your microphone. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, nobody knows for certain what the future holds, but looking in the past, we have done some analysis on a blended rate of the CBR, that is,
the rates of return of the main account and the sub-account. And we have found that if you combine those two and look at the blended rate of return over long periods of time, the PERS and TERS, along with other long-term funds like the Alaska Permanent Fund, outperform that blended rate of return. And therefore, we make the argument that it is better placed in the long-term accounts, the PERS and TERS, than in the CBR. Now, there, of course, is an option of the sub-account of the CBR has a better rate of return than the blended rate of return. But even at that, since you're constricted to investments, which are essentially liquid investments because we have to be able to call on it, we still believe that over the long term, money is better placed in the PERS and TERS than in the CBR, even the sub-account.
Just a quick comment here. With so many people at the microphone, please remember to identify yourselves. You don't have to give your full title. Just say your name for the Senate Secretary as we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm
that's a man.
Gary Bader, Chief Investment Officer of the Department of Revenue.
Right. David, did you have a comment on that? I think Senator Fairclough had directed that as well to David.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think that Gary Bader answered that fully.
Okay. Move for these. Welcome back. Senator Fairclough, your question wasn't answered on the record. Can we maybe get you to reiterate, gentlemen, what you discussed at the 80s?
Thank you, Mr.
If you could restate the question.
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to articulate when we're hearing whether our credit rating is affected by what's before us today in the pension fund liability and how that plays with our reserves. I wanted to know, is it a 20% impact, or was it the range up to 50? And if you look at it narrowly, it's 10% and 10%. But I am correct, and it can be stated now for the record, that 50% of the health of Alaska's credit rating is in play with this particular conversation, at least in the examples that we have here today. And by in play, it's all at 10% swipes, but it's 10% of revenues, 10% on balanced reserves, 10% on liquidity, 10% on bonded indebtedness, bond debt, and 10% on adjusted net pension liabilities. So in total, that comes up to 50%. And however we move inside of there is absolutely a balancing issue. But I just wanted everyone to be clear that it's not just 20% that we're looking at. Those are components of what we're looking at. But the credit rating, depending on whether we act or if we go too far, could be up to 50% of our credit rating. Thank you, Mr.
And I think that's important, too. It is up to, because not each one of those components has the full impact. Each one of those are weighted as well.
Absolutely right.
Did you want to talk about that, or does that pretty much sum up what you would have said?
Through the chair, the only comment I would make is I agree. I misunderstood the question earlier. I thought we were comparing one rating analytic process to another rating agency analytic process. And would add to Senator Fairclough's comments that I think it's at least that amount, that in Alaska's case, we're a somewhat unique credit, so we don't always fit in the box very well, that they try to fit credits in to cross-compare. And so, as a result, some of our strongest criteria, I think, overbalance a little bit. And so, certainly, they carry at least the weight that Senator Fairclough indicated.
Okay. Any other questions? David, gentlemen, if there were some other things that you wanted to say in regard to this discussion, feel free to do it now. If not, I'm going to have David come up and talk to us a little bit more. Is there anything you would, feel free? Don't. If you got something to say, now's the time. Go ahead, Mike.
Mr. Chair, first a word of thanks for my coworkers.
Are you going to riff?
I wanted to thank you because sometimes I've been known to go on at length on subjects I'm interested in, and so as of yesterday they started saying, Mike, you're riffing. Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Administration. Just a few thoughts in wrap up. I very much appreciated Mr. Thiel's presentation because I think he highlighted a number of factors that we definitely spent a fair amount of time thinking about and considering and helping the governor craft the proposal that he put before you, and I'll just identify them. One of the biggest factors to consider is the affordability to the general fund in near term, midterm, and long term. And this is something we're all wrestling with. Some proposals are more affordable in the short term. Some proposals are more affordable in the long term. As Mr. Thiel has shown, that if you look at the end of the day, these curves tend to converge towards the end. But looking separately at each of those terms, short term, midterm, and long term, is an important balancing that we have to do today. We also need to focus on the all-in cost to the state, budget certainty. And so one factor that I don't think was highlighted much in Mr. Thiel's presentation is under the governor's proposal, when you switch to a fixed contribution system, you are creating at least near-term budget certainty in that fixed payment. And that's important, particularly as we're looking at using these next 5 years as a transition time towards getting to an investment and potential investment in a gas pipeline. Plan acceptability to stakeholders is also important. There are a huge array of stakeholders. Practically every Alaskan is a stakeholder in some fashion. And the acceptability of the various plans, or the relative acceptability of the various proposals put before the committee is important. Some proposals, unfortunately, fall far short of acceptability to some stakeholders. What we're looking for is a sweet spot. We're looking for a proposal that is hopefully more than marginally acceptable to most stakeholders. And we think the governor's plan starts to approach that for many stakeholders. We're looking to balance stakeholder interests. And finally, we're looking at the various risks to beneficiaries that the various proposals present. And we think the governor's proposal decreased in some fashion risks to beneficiaries, and that's important. It's important not only to the beneficiaries, it's important to balancing stakeholder interests. So I'll stop riffing there. I'm happy to answer questions, but we do agree, as this graph shows, there are a variety of plans. They have all of the plans, proposals have pros and cons, but ultimately what we're looking for is a fair, acceptable balance in terms of a proposal.
We have a knees just for a moment. If you could stay in place. Back on the record. Thank you, gentlemen, if that's all you had. Oh, Mr. Boucher, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Boucher from the Office of Management and Budget. And I also want to extend the administration's thanks for the engagement of this committee and Mr. Teal in this difficult issue. And one thing I just wanted to comment on in the opening remarks, David very graphically put in front of us some of the challenges that we face for the next 10 years. And this retirement problem being one of the biggest one of those. And so what I didn't want to leave the committee with the impression with is that the administration is not aware of these problems, and that we would happily spend our way out of our reserves for the next 10 years. I think the administration has demonstrated over the last couple of years that we're serious about trying to curb the operating budget and address, at the same time, address some of these big issues, such as the retirement system, such as Medicaid spending. So I just didn't want to leave the impression for those primarily out in the public out there that, you know, we're just on our way to spending all our reserves. And we appreciate that this is a balancing act. And we look forward to being in partnership with you during these deliberations as we move toward the next 10 years. And I just want to thank all the members of this committee for their good stewardship on behalf of all Alaskans.
Thank you, Mr. Boucher. David, could you get back front? Oh, Senator Fairclough, if you have another question.
Mr. Chairman, you've been really good when we have dialogue on some of these huge issues to do more like a kitchen cabinet kind of a conversation, and maybe we'll have that in a little bit. But Mr. Teal pointed to some considerations that I was wondering about that roundtable conversation. Yeah. 20 or 30 years, what does that mean to local municipalities versus the state of Alaska, and some dialogue on that 20 to 30 years? Level dollar percentage, Mr. Teal, under your leadership, came to Fairbanks and presented in front of this committee about level dollar to front load versus back load the system. And Alaskans will be interested to know how that plays out, because that is going to be part of, if we advance something, how to do that. So, and then a goal. If we know that we can't go the full yard, the full measure to do $11.9 billion right now, you know, to have a funded plan, then where would be the first step that we would start? And, you know, it seems like 70% is at least the first step for some of that. But I just, those three items are would be of interest to me to hear everyone's perspective on, so that we can really tease out what it does for Alaska, what it does for the balancing that we're considering, and then what it does for the other cities that we're going to impact. Because Mr. Teal appropriately pointed out that when that unfunded liability is spread to our local communities, some of them are going to be upside down in assets versus debt.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. David, you want to go ahead and take center stage there? General, if you want to go ahead and sit down for a while. Let David get back to his computer. You know, Senator Fairclough brings up a good point. If I could just get the committee's attention for a second, that some of our best work, I think, has been done when we just start having dialogue with each other at this table. It's a little difficult for the Senate secretaries to follow sometimes, but this is obviously a very important discussion, and we need to be able to talk and ask the questions that need to be asked. So, Mr. Teal, could you walk us through what the options look like, for instance, if you go level percent of pay versus level dollar, 25 versus 30-year, you have something you can show us on that? And I think what you showed me earlier today, that you thought you might have a little more digestible view of it tomorrow or the next day. I guess we don't have a next day, do we?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that there's a way to make this more digestible. It's just
no, I mean, the 25 versus 30 years.
It's not easy stuff to grasp. And what I can show you here is, if you're looking at 25 versus 30, that sort of thing, there is, starting at this point, a $2 billion cash infusion. Level percent of pay, which is this dashed line, and you can see where it goes,
right.
It starts lower. It crosses over where all of them do,
right
around the 23, 24. Beyond that point, level percent of pay means that you are paying more as payroll increases. And payroll will increase over time, and that level percent of pay will increase along with payroll, making it, because it pays less up front, ends up costing you more in the long run. If you go to the next line here, this is what happens if you just amortized over 30 years. Again, it's a little more expensive up front than level percent of pay, but the key thing is it extends those payments longer. And because it doesn't flatten out, you end up continuing to climb, just as pay-as-you-go will continue to climb. So it's a trade-off between the near-term and the long-term. It's that's, you know, getting back to the mortgage example, if you're a 15-year mortgage kind of person, you will choose level dollar because it pays your debt off faster. And level dollar simply means that it is more like a mortgage, that you pay a constant dollar amount, which is similar to the governor's. You've got, under the governor's plan, a fixed 343. Well, under level percent of pay, just taking, this is the data that's graphed. If you go level dollar, you're going to be right in here at $196 million a year. Now it varies slightly, but it's as opposed to the governor's plan where you have a fixed amount of payments, that will not vary unless you don't appropriate the full amount. But that set at exactly $343 million. But you can go to a $2 billion cash infusion with 25-year amortization and pay $196 million a year. And you'll notice that it extends those payments for, well, basically 2 years. It cuts it off, but these are your choices. It's much like taking out a mortgage. You can increase your down payment. You know that the more you put down on your home, the lower your payments are going to be. You also know that you can have a 30-year term and your payments will be lower, but in the end, it costs you more. So those are your three levers. How much cash do I want to put down right now? How much annual payment do I want to make, and how long do I want to make it? And that's where the balancing act comes in, along with balancing, well, do I want my flexible reserves or do I want my reserves to be tied up in retirement? Tying them up in retirement is great because you're earning 8% instead of 4%, and you have a healthier system. But that balancing act is one in which, how healthy do you have to be? In other words, those credit raters say 10%, call it 10 points, on your unfunded liability. If we were at 100%, you might get 10 points. If we're at 80%, you might get 9 points. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't go directly proportionally. But if you're down below 50%, you're going to be downgraded for having an unsafe or unhealthy system. And you can see these level dollar is exactly that, level dollar. Here, level percent of pay starts out with lower payments, but as payroll climbs, you're going from paying less than the level dollar to, in the end, paying more. 316 versus 190. It's just your choice of methods. And your methods make a difference. You can see that level percent of pay, same $2 billion cash infusion, you're going to be paying $8 billion. If you use level dollar amortization method, you're going to save $1.2 billion because now it only costs you 6.8.
Which is fine if you want to, if you don't have some of their goals in mind, which we do. We have to. I mean, we don't gain that much anywhere by 2024. 2024 is when all the models show us dropping off. However, we can hang on to some of those dollars longer within that window, which is what we're trying to do, or at least what my vision of what we're trying to do. It's the only reason I like level percent of pay better than level dollar. And the cash infusion, I don't want to be massive. I mean, I think we have to get up. I think my view of what our goal should be is to get up into the kind of the healthy range, which you're saying is somewhere in the 70% range. The infusions need to be in the 70% range. I like going weighted towards TERS because we pay all that. And the only reason I like level percent of pay is that it gives us some flexibility between now and 2024, where we're trying to get to a point where we can get more revenue.
And Mr. Chairman, on that, I would point out that regardless of which method you choose, it's like taking a 30-year mortgage. You do not have to pay that payment. You're always allowed to put in more money if you choose to.
Sure. Right. Senator Bishop.
You know, great discussion today. Thanks for the free flow and dialogue. I appreciate it. But, you know, I keep coming back around to rating eight. You know, we can talk about level percentage, level dollar. I think we're getting it narrowed down here. And now it's a little bit philosophical, and then it's mathematics. But I keep coming back to rating agencies. And I think I heard you say a little earlier that NCLS, their actuarial method plan, they made a suggestion that we put this in statute, whichever way we're going to go forward on payment. I don't know if I'm quoting you correctly.
Through the chair, pretty close. Yeah.
Pretty close. Okay, so keeping in mind these big projects, I still want to keep our bond rating healthy. You know, so there you know, so we've heard three different scenarios why we want to keep our bond rating healthy. I've heard it from the commissioner, I've heard it from you, and not putting words in your mouth, but from other smart people, NCLS making those same kinds of recommendations. And another thing that I just want to say for 1 second is it is huge what we're doing here, but for people at home that don't have the luxury of looking at all the stuff that we have, this money that we're, the infusion that's going to be put in, whichever shape or form, that money's not lost on Alaska's economy. That money goes right into a bank account that then is spent in this state and keeps our economy turning. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Before we go any further, we should probably talk about the municipalities and the impact on the municipalities with the GASP changes. Which of you is probably most qualified to talk on that? I see Riff and Mike, come on up. So, Mr. Barnhill, that's the question. Obviously, we sit here at this table and talk about putting $2 billion in to, or more into TERS than into PERS in relationship. I know it's the governor's desire to do it the other way. I would ask you to, if you can just give us some answers and not try to sell the governor's position, but let's hear about the municipalities. So.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board adopted two, they call them GASB statements. GASB 67 becomes effective in FY14 this fiscal year, and it requires all public pension plans that have multiple employers to take the unfunded liability, which they've renamed the net pension liability, and allocate that amongst the employers. And then in FY15, for all public employers that are participants in a public pension plan, they have to take that allocated net pension liability and put that on their balance sheet.
So if we're carrying it, if we're making the payments, say, we're not making all of them, obviously the municipalities are making 22%, but the portion that we're carrying, they have to carry as well. If no matter what we do, if we carry a portion of their unfunded liability, they have to carry it on their books and we have to carry it on our books as well?
So, Mr. Chair, so there's a special situation, they call it special funding. And in a special funding situation where you have a third-party entity that pays on behalf of a participating employer, and that third-party entity is quote-unquote legally responsible for the underlying obligation, then that third-party entity is supposed to pick up the payments that are attributable to that net pension liability and put it on their books. There's an open question under GASB 68 whether the state of Alaska falls into the category of legally responsible, and therefore we would pick up that difference. So to put it in concrete numbers, in FY15, the employer contribution rate is going to be 44%. And the employer contribution rate cap is 22%. So under the current methodology, the state would pay the difference between 44 and 22%, 22%. And if the state falls into that category of legally responsible, we would pick up the net pension liability attributable to that 22% payment and put that on our books.
Now, and are they subsequently relieved of that at that point?
They would be relieved of putting that liability on their books in that year. Now, what I wanted to say as a caveat to that is that's an open question. In Alaska, we have prohibition against dedicated funds, and so the Department of Law has, at this point, informally advised that the statute that provides for that funding is not enforceable, right? It's subject to appropriation. So it's more akin to a situation where you've got someone, go back to the house mortgage situation. I buy a house, I take out a mortgage, and my parents make payments on my behalf for a period of 5 years. They didn't sign the note. They just felt sorry for me and for my financial state as a Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. So the question is, in that situation, does the mere payment on my behalf make them obligers under the note? And any lawyer will tell you, no, they didn't sign the note, they can't enforce it, they just made a charitable payment. So that's the legal issue, that's the legal tension. Now, we've been told by accountants, folks that have worked on this for the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, that GASB absolutely intends for entities like the state that are doing this to pick up that special funding on our books. But I don't think when they were drafting this that the lawyers and the accountants fully engaged on this issue. And I think there's absolutely a plausible argument that the state is not legally responsible for these payments. But it remains an item under discussion within the administration with the Department of Law.
If I could continue here, what's the impact on the municipalities? Okay, so now nothing's changed, but they're now carrying this on their books. What happens to them?
Okay, so let me just clarify a bit. When I say unfunded liability carrying on the books, there's an important caveat, and that is GASB 67 and 68 only apply to pension liability, not to health liability. Yeah. So of that $11.9 billion unfunded liability, about 3.8 of that is health liability, so it's only the balance we're talking about related to pension liability.
Yeah.
The other important caveat is that under the GASB rules, they will not allow actuarial smoothing, so we would use market value of assets. The markets for the last year and a half.
Go ahead, before you go any further, let us know what that is, the smoothing.
Well, when there's gains or losses, the actuaries will take 20% of those and move them into the actuarial value of assets and smooth that gain and loss over a five-year time period.
Okay.
Under the GASB method, all of the gains would come in the same year, all of the losses would come. So it's a more volatile asset figure.
Okay. So now they're picking up the pension obligation. What happens to them?
Sure. So let's take Anchorage, for instance. We would allocate that pension liability to each of the municipalities. Anchorage's on a contribution basis, the amount they contribute to PERS, and on a payroll basis, the amount of their payroll as measured by Anchorage's payroll divided by total payroll. They're about 8%. So we would take 8% of the pension liability for PERS and allocate that to Anchorage, and Anchorage would then put it on its balance sheet.
And then what happens?
Then what happens? Well, you'll have to have Anchorage speak to how, first of all, Anchorage has multiple balance sheets they've got utilities, they've got various funds, and how they allocate that amongst their balance sheets, I don't know.
If we're contemplating waiting this decision, we're going to put X amount out there in some kind of cash infusion. If we're talking about waiting it towards TERS instead of PERS, this is the immediate consequence that comes to my mind, is this GASB rule change. So I guess what I'm just trying to dig down to is, other than wailing and gnashing of teeth, what are the actual financial implications? What checks are written as a result of this? And if you don't know, then that's fine too. Or if you're
Mr. Chair, I do know that there has been wailing and gnashing of teeth because we've got a huge unfunded liability, and the prospect of taking a meaningful percentage of that is not a welcome one for any of the municipalities. With respect to allocating between PERS and TERS, my understanding is that for TERS, this will be a requirement as well. Many municipalities consolidate their school district balance sheets on the municipality balance sheet. So presumably, but I don't want to speak for them, those municipalities may be indifferent whether the funding is weighted to TERS or PERS. Beyond that, I don't know.
Okay. David, do you have any ideas? I mean, it's been a long time since I took my advanced accounting classes, and I just don't remember what the impact of carrying those things on your balance sheet means when we're still picking up the check. No one is anticipating that we're not going to pay that check. Am I right, committee? I mean, that's not your idea, is it? So I guess my point is that we have transferred that liability because of the GASB changes. What now happens to the municipality in actual check-writing consequences?
Mr. Chairman, I would say
very little in terms of actual check writing costs. What it does affect is their credit rating.
Right.
And that can be a big issue.
Which is, ends up in check writing costs.
Which does end up in future checks. And as Mike Barnhill said, each employer can be allocated a share of the unfunded liability. And for instance, here's share of unfunded liability. Anchorage is 8% of payroll, therefore is allocated $657 million of the unfunded liability. Now, on their balance sheet, they'll carry about 60% of that because nearly 40% is going to be health care costs. But it's still a large amount of money. And there are a couple things that are sort of odd. Our law allows any employer, for instance, the municipality of Anchorage, to make an extra payment. So, and credit that payment to their own account. Meaning that if Anchorage had a spare $100 million laying around, which I don't mean to imply that they do, but they could pay down their unfunded liability and have it reduce their rate in the future. Given our situation of payments on behalf and the cash flow of the municipalities, I can't imagine that ever being applied. It's there, but it doesn't make any real difference. You look at the shares of unfunded liability here. There are few, if any, municipalities that you would expect to be able to come up with. Juneau cannot come up with $132 million to pay off its unfunded liability any more than Anchorage can come up with $650. Now, when you go back to this as in general, the state share of the unfunded liability, $8 billion roughly, the state itself is responsible for about half of it. The university is another $500 million. Then PERS is also big in school districts. Well, since we pay PERS as a school district PERS as part of the state formula, we're actually responsible for another 15%. So it's really only 22% of the unfunded liability that would fall on municipalities. But you saw what that is. The numbers are crushing, even at 22%. So having any of that appear on your books, again, doesn't mean that they have to write bigger payroll checks or pay more money in contributions to the state. But if they are borrowing, their credit rating will show a downgrade, and they will not be able to borrow at those low costs unless they're using the municipal bond bank, and that uses different credit.
Senator Bishop?
Thank you. I'm almost totally confused now. Now that you've kicked in these Gatsby rules, 67 and 68, and you start talking about who's responsible, 44 or 22%, I'm in question, are we doing the right thing and are we putting the right money up here now, or should we take a powder and take a step back and wait till these Gatsby rules get implemented so we know how it's going to be, where we put the correct allocation? Because what I'm thinking is, if this question doesn't get answered in the liability, we could have more of an obligation as a state under PERS than the municipalities. And their balance sheet could get better and ours could get worse. So I just want to make sure that I might be off base and not heard anything right.
Well, we're already carrying it on our balance sheet, correct? I don't think ours can get worse, can it, under the scenario that Senator Bishop's just described?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe anyone has carried this actual unfunded liability on its balance sheet.
Oh, okay.
No one's done that. Nobody wants to do it, really. Yeah. But I think the simple answer to your question, Senator Bishop, is if the concern is about municipal balance sheets, any deposit into the PERS trust fund will serve to reduce the total of the unfunded liability, which will reduce the amount that gets allocated to the municipal balance sheets, whether or not we have special funding or not. So it's just we're just reducing the unfunded liability, which will reduce the allocated amount, which helps municipalities.
Okay, which helps municipalities, but you know, I'm just because I keep, you know, this ratings agency and our credit rating keeps revolving back around in my head, and I just want to make sure that what we do today, that we won't come back 2 years from now and say we should have put more cash in now because of Gatsby 67 or 68 has made a hard, fast decision. That's my only point. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, if Gatsby impacts us in ways that we don't expect, if you put in a small amount of money here, and I don't mean small, like $1.5 billion, $2 billion towards PERS, Anchorage, for instance, would benefit immediately by going, well, if you put in $2 billion, which is a nice easy way to look at it, is you're paying off one quarter of your unfunded liability. That would reduce Anchorage's share of the unfunded liability by one quarter as well. So roughly $150 million or so, except that we've got health in there. But if Gatsby does something that makes the municipalities look very bad and the state chooses to, they could put another $1 billion in next year or the year after. If Gatsby affects municipalities in a way that is just unworkable for them. This is, I think, what we're proposing, what the governor is proposing, is not a complete payoff of the unfunded liability. I don't think that that's a good approach. And I think as the administration has testified, they're looking for a sweet spot, that balance between paying things off now, helping the municipalities, having reserves still available, having a healthy retirement system, and then you get the balance between pay now or pay more later. And all of it just means you got a tough time figuring out a fiscal note. Because that's really all it amounts to here is if you're going to deposit some money, and this is not something new. There was a bill 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Senator Hoffman, that did essentially this same thing. Unfortunately, at that time, we, you know, those of us that were working on this could see this situation coming, and at that time said, there's a surplus now, and we see deficits coming. Better to do this now when we have the money, because it's going to be much more difficult to do when we're actually experiencing deficits. Well, that's the situation we're in right now. That bill didn't move 3 years ago, and you know, whatever the reasons for that were, the issue has not gone away. It's just been made more difficult because we've gone from surpluses to deficits. But it doesn't relieve the responsibility of that debt, and it doesn't make it any easier to pay off. It doesn't change that balance point of you're better off contributing now than later.
Thank you for the latitude, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I heard Mr. Till you say that a 50% funded plan is going to be downgraded and is considered an unhealthy system. And before us, as of the last time that we have numbers, we have a 52.1% TERS plan that absolutely needs some cash infusion. And so when I'm trying to consider the TERS, and the chairman is, certainly I support where the chairman is going in pushing, if we're going to put money in a system, that it should be put in the TERS system. And so we were talking, where we originally started was about level pay versus the percentage based off of your liability. And so my question was, how does that affect us, and then how does it affect communities? And what I think I heard you say is level pay will front load the system, and let that cash work for us over time, and percentage of pay will meet our obligations actuarially. Is that accurate?
You actually, well, through the chair, yeah, actually it's referred to as level dollar and level percent, but yes, you're right.
Mr. Chairman, so for my constituents at home or for other Alaskans, for me, the difference between level pay or a percentage, I'm sorry, level dollar or a percentage, I look at my credit card and I say, do I want to make interest payments, which would be the percentage? Would that be fair? And if I want to make payments on my principal, I'm going to do a level dollar. So if I've got credit card debt that I owe, at a higher percentage of interest rate, I'm going to pay off my loan sooner if I don't just make interest payments.
Through the chair, that's certainly correct, but even under level percent, you are doing far more than paying just the interest payments. You are paying your debt off. But again, I'll go to the table. I think it's easier if you look at these two columns. The level $2 billion cash infusion, one is level percent of pay, one is level dollar. Again, the same $2 billion up front, and now the difference is you pay less in the early years, $170 million versus $220. So there's substantial savings there, $50 million. But at some point, those lines cross, and you will be paying more under level percent out in the future. You will pay longer under level percent of pay. So if you're looking for the cheaper way to pay off the same debt, level dollar will cost you 6.8, level percent will cost you 7.9. You save $1 billion by choosing a different amortization method. Doesn't make the payments any easier to make. You know.
I'm going to lose my credit card if I don't make my payments. Mr. Teal, if I might, Mr. Co-Chair, is that on a 20-year, 25, or a 30-year period? Because that was the other issue that I was hoping that the committee would discuss. So, again, simply if I financed my car or my house over a longer period of time, I have payments that are easier to make, but I'm going to pay more money to make those payments easier.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, this is 20. Both of these columns that are highlighted are 25-year amortization. There's one over here that has the same $2 billion cash infusion that goes for 30 years. And as you can see, the payments are lower, as you would expect. But you're paying. Instead of ending your payments in 2036, you are making payments till 2042. The cost of that is 7.2. So it hits roughly between the other two methods.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the current payment plan that we're on right now to address our unfunded liability, did we start that on a 20-year period, 25 or 30?
Through the chair, we are on a 25-year period. The law allows us to go as high as 30.
So I would just, Mr. Chairman, let the committee know. My issue is this. So we've been down the road for a period of years that we partnered to address, under the current plan, our liability. And so since we're talking about houses, we're talking about refinancing our debt and carrying it longer, or shortening it back up to the 20-year time period so that we would still pay off in a reasonable amount of time. Is that a fair analysis? And my concern is to cities. I represent an urban area. We have quite a few municipal employees and other employees that are inside the system. And so my understanding is their effect of us taking a longer period of time to pay off the debt is going to cost them a lot of money, upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars, the longer we extend that by making it easier for us. Is that fair?
Yes, Yes.
And Senator Fairclough, the only disagreement I have is that everything you said stated is true. It has to do with the situation the homeowner or the credit card holder finds themselves in. Right now, we don't have reliable revenue. We don't have reliable income. We don't know what the future is going to hold, far more than the average household person does. But if you are deciding whether you're going to make longer payments on your credit card or shorter payments on your credit card that ate your cash up more quickly, you would balance that against whether your kid had to have a medical treatment or go to school, or whether you knew that you were going to have to buy a new car and you had to husband some of those dollars at that period of time. And I think that's where we find ourselves in the state now, is I don't know that we have the luxury to be saving money in the way long term when we're trying to get to the gas line. We're trying to get to new revenues. The unfortunate thing is that graph that you showed us doesn't help you that much. But as I look on the 25-year versus the 30-year, and I see that your 30-year payment is that $159,920 versus $432,000?
This, Mr. Chairman, this column,
that's your 30
here, is the 30-year.
Right. And where's your 25?
25 years over here.
Oh, I see.
So the payment, for instance, in 2021, here is 198, here it's 182.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Here it continues at 196, right. And here it continues at 180. So each year you could look at this as, well, I'm saving $15 million a year. That's great. But when you take it out to the end, you are paying.
Right. Well, I understand
longer that it costs more.
Right. The comparison between the 25 and the 25 and the 30, I guess the one I was trying to compare more is between the level dollar and the level percentage of pay, and that's, I mean, on your spreadsheet.
Okay.
I thought you had that on your spreadsheet.
I do.
Yeah.
But I can show it on the spreadsheet just as well, I guess, or on the graph. But here, again, the two highlighted columns. The first one is level percent of pay. It starts out paying 170 versus 230. So it's $50 million lower payments in the early years. Out here, you're at 198 and 196 by 2024. That's what that graph was showing me. There's a crossover point here. And now you'll see that level percent of pay has gone up to $250 million, while level dollar has remained at $195. So out in the future, level percent is going to cost you $50, $60, and you know, now you're at 191 versus 300. So it's going to cost you $100 million a year more under level percent of pay. And you pay 2 years longer.
Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
But you're looking at a schedule here, and it's just for TERS, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But when we have these graphs, which show level percentage and level dollars, when you look at, say, year 2018, under level dollars, you're looking at $1 billion in payments, and under level percentage in 18, you're showing under 800,000. So there's a $200,000 difference, or $200 million difference. And I think that goes to the chairman's point. When you look at the total of the two, and the graphs are greatly different, gradually increasing versus starting high and coming down. Where are we going to be financially to get us to where everybody at this table wants to go, which is building the gas line? Are we going to be able to do build a gas line with our cash calls at 2024 when our payout under percentage level percent is you know, $9 billion and 2024 on level dollars is you know, a little bit less than that? And that is the, I think, the ultimate decision that this committee needs to make when we're considering what we want to do with PERS and TERS, which is a big liability that we know we want to address, but we are going to need the gas line out past 2024 in order to hit the obligations between 2024 and 2032. And I think that's where you're referring to the additional issues that the state has to play with. And somewhere we have to put those cash calls into a schedule to see where we're going as a state.
And I think what you said, Senator Hoffman, obviously we would agree on what you just said. You were kind of picking up on the point I was making. But as Mr. Teal said when we began, it's a little tough to try to make our reserve solutions in dealing with the PERS-TERS model. It has to be spending or revenue. Otherwise, most of them, I mean, all the pictures that we are shown on PERS-TERS, the news is never good. And we can adjust them by putting in this amount or going level pay, level dollar. It all kind of ends up not so good. Senator Dunleavy, and then Mr. Teal, go ahead.
Chair, when you look at level percent versus level dollars, if you're looking at a historical, you're projecting out 20, 25 years, and if you're looking at historical inflation rates, or even a little bit of hyperinflation if there's a scenario where we stop buying our bonds and we have to start paying for these dollars. What scenario works better under a increasing or growing inflationary situation over 10, 15, 20, 20 years from your perspective? The level dollar or the level percentage? When is inflation your ally? In what scenario is your inflation your ally?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, you're looking at me, so I assume you want me to say something. It depends on your estimation of how the investment markets are correlated to inflation. So if you're in a hyperinflation environment and that results in booming equity markets, then I double down on the level dollar. It's not always the case, but it sometimes is the case. Mr. Bader's here to talk about markets.
Mr. Teal, go ahead.
Well, I agree with Mike Barnhill on that one, and would add that, remember, our pensions are essentially fixed costs.
Yeah. Well, they are.
Oh. And so that with inflation, those pensions erode. Now, there are adjustments to pensions and so on, and it's a really difficult question because inflation now means that salaries would go up. As salaries go up, your benefits go up. That means that, you know, your pension liabilities are going to climb with inflation. But if your market returns also climb with inflation, it's all offset. This is the kind of thing you can put in a model, but the outcome is determined completely by what you assume. And I can't mentally figure out whether high inflation is going to help you or hurt you here. It's going to affect you in many ways.
Kind of like to get wrapped up by 3:30. We're going to hear from you again tomorrow, David. Any other questions, Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, it's not a question, so I'll just stake my dirt. Level dollar pay is the best way to go for the people of Alaska and the system. And if we are making a decision based on a large project, I don't think that we're focusing on the right outcome. The market is going to be and do what the market does, and if we have a good project, we are going to be able to borrow low, and everyone is going to be at the table to buy those bonds. We have $1 billion on the table in that decision.
Senator Meyer?
Can we have brief at ease?
Okay. We're going to go ahead and adjourn, but before we do, Senator Meyer, could you talk about schedules, please?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as you know, we got a lot of new bills that came over that were read across today. So we haven't set the schedule yet. We have till 4 o'clock to do that, but tentatively we're planning on House Bill 121, Commercial Fishing and Agricultural Bank, House Bill 204, Salmon and Herring Product Development Tax Credit, House Bill 379, which is the Oil and Gas Property Tax Cap Bill. That's Senator Olson has a Senate companion. House Bill 308, Alaska Securities Act Exemptions, House Bill 361, Licensing of Behavior Analysts, House Bill 160, Licensing of Athletic Trainers, and House Bill 116, PERS Credit for Military Service, as well as some other bills previously heard, as well as hopefully having an education bill to bring forward tomorrow.
Yep. Any other business to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.